doing or do I have to shoot you?
Depends on what you're doing.
It's hard to come up with an answer when I'm not even sure. I stand facing the Hancock building. To my right are the factionless, Evelyn and her collection of death serum. To my left are the Allegiant, Marcus, and the insurrection plan. Where do I have the greatest influence? Where can I make the biggest difference? Those are the questions I should be asking myself. Instead, I am asking myself whose destruction I am more desperate for. I'm going to stop a revolution, I say. I turn right, and Peter follows me.
Chapter 45. Triss. My brother stands behind the microscope, his eye pressed to the eyepiece. The light in the microscope platform casts strange shadows on his face, making him look years older. "This is definitely it," he says. "The attack simulation serum, I mean. No question." "It's always good to have another person verify," Matthew says. I am standing with my brother in the hours before he dies, and he is analyzing serums. It's so stupid. I know why Caleb wanted to come here, to make sure that he was giving his life for a good reason. I don't blame him. There are no second chances after you've died for something, at least as far as I know. "Tell me the activation code again," Matthew says. "The activation code will enable the memory serum weapon, and another button will deploy it instantly. Matthew has made Caleb repeat them both every few minutes since we got here." "I've no trouble memorizing sequences of numbers," Caleb says. "I don't doubt that, but we don't know what state of mind you'll be in when the death serum begins to take its course, and these codes need to be deeply ingrained." Caleb flinches at the words, "death serum." I stare at my shoes. 080712, Caleb says. And then I press the green button. Right now, Kara is spending some time with the people in the control room so she can spike their beverages with peace serum and shut off the lights in the compound while they're too drunk to notice, just like Nita and Tobias did a few weeks ago. When she does that, we'll run for the weapons lab, unseen by the cameras in the dark. Sitting across from me on the lab table are the explosives Reggie gave us. They look so ordinary. Inside a black box with metal claws on the edges and a remote detonator. The claws will attach the box to the second set of laboratory doors. The first set still hasn't been repaired since the attack. "I think that's it," Matthew says. "Now all we have to do is wait for a little while." "Matthew," I say, "do you think you could leave us alone for a bit?" "Of course," Matthew smiles. "I'll come back when it's time." He closes the door behind him. Caleb runs his hands over the clean suit, the explosives, the backpack they go in. He puts them all in a straight line, fixing this corner and that one. "I keep thinking about when we were young and we played candor," he says. "How I used to sit you down in a chair in the living room and ask you questions. Remember?" "Yes," I say. I lean my hips into the lab table. "You used to find the pulse in my wrist and tell me that if I lied, you would be able to tell, because the candor can always tell when other people are lying. It wasn't very nice." Caleb laughs. "That one time, you confessed to stealing a book from the school library just as Mom came home, and I had to go to the librarian and apologize." I laugh too. "That librarian was awful. She always called everyone young lady or young man." "Oh, she loved me, though. Did you know that when I was a library volunteer and was supposed to be shelving books during my lunch hour, I was really just standing in the aisles and reading? She caught me a few times and never said anything about it." "Really?" I feel a twinge in my chest. "I didn't know that." "There was a lot we didn't know about each other, I guess." He taps his fingers on the table. "I wish we had been able to be more honest with each other." "Me too. And it's too late now, isn't it?" He looks up. "Not for everything." I pull out a chair from the lab table and sit in it. "Let's play candor. I'll answer a question, and then you have to answer a question. Honestly, obviously. He looks a little exasperated, but he plays along. Okay. What did you really do to break those glasses in the kitchen when you claimed that you were taking them out to clean water spots off them? I roll my eyes. That's the one question you want an honest answer to? Come on, Caleb. Okay, fine. He clears his throat, and his green eyes fix on mine, serious. Have you really forgiven me? Or are you just saying that you have because I'm about to die? I stare at my hands, which rest in my lap. I've been able to be kind and pleasant to him because every time I think of what happened in Erudite headquarters, I immediately push the thought aside. But that can't be forgiveness. If I had forgiven him, I would be able to think of what happened without that hatred I can feel in my gut, right? Or maybe forgiveness is just the continual pushing aside of bitter memories until time dulls the hurt and the anger and the wrong is forgotten. For Caleb's sake, I choose to believe the latter. Yes, I have, I say. I pause. Or at least, I desperately want to. And I think that might be the same thing. He looks relieved. I step aside so he can take my place in the chair. I know what I want to ask him, and have since he volunteered to make this sacrifice. What is the biggest reason that you're doing this? I say. The most important one. Don't ask me that, Beatrice. It's not a trap, I say. It won't make me unforgive you. I just need to know. Between us are the clean suit, the explosives, and the backpack, arranged in a line on the brushed steel. They are the instruments of his going and not coming back. I guess I feel like it's the only way I can escape the guilt for all the things I've done, he says. I've never wanted anything more than I want to be rid of it. His words ache inside me. I was afraid he would say that. I knew he would say that all along. I wish he hadn't said it. A voice speaks through the intercom in the corner. Attention all compound residents. Commence emergency lockdown procedure, effective until 5 o'clock a.m. I repeat, commence emergency lockdown procedure, effective until 5 o'clock a.m. Caleb and I exchange an alarmed look. Matthew shoves the door open. Shit, he says, and then louder, shit! Emergency lockdown? I say. Is that the same as an attack drill? Basically, it means we have to go now, while there's still chaos in the hallways, and before they increase security, Matthew says. Why would they do this? Caleb says. Could be they just want to increase security before releasing the viruses, Matthew says. Or it could be that they figured out we're going to try something. Only if they knew that, they probably would have come to arrest us. I look at Caleb. The minutes I had left with him fall away like dead leaves pulled from branches. I cross the room and retrieve our guns from the counter. But itching at the back of my mind is what Tobias said yesterday. That the abnegation say you should only let someone sacrifice himself for you if it's the ultimate way for them to show they love you. And for Caleb, that's not what this is.
Chapter 46. Tobias. My feet slip on the snowy pavement. You didn't inoculate yourself yesterday, I say to Peter.
No, I didn't, Peter says.
Why not?
Why should I tell you?
I run my thumb over the vial and say, you came with me because you know I have the memory serum, right? If you want me to give it to you, it couldn't hurt to give me a reason. He looks at my pocket again like he did earlier. He must have seen Christina give it to me. He says,
I'd rather just take it from you.
Please. I lift my eyes up to watch the snow spilling over the edges of the building. It's dark, but the moon provides just enough light to see by. You might think you're pretty good at fighting, but you aren't good enough to beat me. I promise you. Without warning, he shoves me. Hard, and I slip on the snowy ground and fall. My gun clatters to the ground, half buried in the snow. That'll teach me to get cocky, I think. And I scramble to my feet.
He grabs my collar and yanks me forward so I slide again, only this time I keep my balance and elbow him in the stomach. He kicks me hard in the leg, making it go numb, and grabs the front of my jacket to pull me toward him. His hand fumbles for my pocket where the serum is. I try to push him away, but his footing is too sure, and my leg is still too numb. With a groan of frustration, I bring my free arm back by my face and slam my elbow into his mouth. Pain spreads through my arm. It hurts to hit someone in the teeth, but it was worth it. He yells, sliding back onto the street, his face clutched in both hands. "You know why you won fights as an initiate?" I say as I get to my feet. "Because you're cruel. Because you like to hurt people. And you think you're special. You think everyone around you is a bunch of sissies who can't make the tough choices like you can." He starts to get up, and I kick him in the side so he goes sprawling again. Then I press my foot to his chest right under his throat, and our eyes meet. He is wide and innocent and nothing like what's inside him. "You are not special," I say. "I like to hurt people, too. I can make the cruelest choice. The difference is, sometimes I don't, and you always do. And that makes you evil." I step over him and start down Michigan Avenue again. But before I take more than a few steps, I hear his voice. "That's why I want it," he says, his voice shaking. I stop. I don't turn around. I don't want to see his face right now. "I want the serum because I'm sick of being this way," he says. "I'm sick of doing bad things and liking it and then wondering what's wrong with me. I want it to be over. I want to start again." "And you don't think that's the coward's way out?" I say over my shoulder. "I think I don't care if it is or not," Peter says. I feel the anger that was swelling within me deflate as I turn the vial over in my fingers inside my pocket. I hear him get to his feet and brush the snow from his clothes. "Don't try to mess with me again," I say, "and I promise I'll let you reset yourself when all this is said and done. I have no reason not to." He nods, and we continue through the unmarked snow to the building where I last saw my mother.
Chapter 47. Triss. There is a nervous kind of quiet in the hallway, though there are people everywhere. One woman bumps me with her shoulder and then mutters an apology, and I move closer to Caleb so I don't lose sight of him. Sometimes, all I want is to be a few inches taller, so the world does not look like a dense collection of torsos. We move quickly, but not too quickly. The more security guards I see, the more pressure I feel building inside me. Caleb's backpack, with the clean suit and explosives inside it, bounces against his lower back as we walk. People are moving in all different directions, but soon, we will reach a hallway that no one has any reason to walk down. "I think something must have happened to Kara," Matthew says. "The lights were supposed to be off by now." I nod. I feel the gun digging into my back, disguised by my baggy shirt. I had hoped that I wouldn't have to use it, but it seems that I will. And even then, it might not be enough to get us to the weapons lab. I touch Caleb's arm, and Matthew's, stopping all three of us in the middle of the hallway. "I have an idea," I say. We split up. Caleb and I will run to the lab, and Matthew, cause some kind of diversion. "A diversion? You have a gun, don't you?" I say. "Fire into the air." He hesitates. "Do it," I say through gritted teeth. Matthew takes his gun out. I grab Caleb's elbow and steer him down the hallway. Over my shoulder, I watch Matthew lift the gun over his head and fire straight up at one of the glass panels above him. At the sharp bang, I burst into a run, dragging Caleb with me. Screams and shattering glass fill the air, and security guards run past us without noticing that we are running away from the dormitories, running toward a place we should not be. It's a strange thing to feel my instincts and dauntless training kick in. My breathing becomes deeper, more even, as we follow the route we determined this morning. My mind feels sharper, clearer. I look at Caleb, expecting to see the same thing happening to him, but all the blood seems to have drained from his face, and he is gasping. I keep my hand firm on his elbow to steady him. We round a corner, shoes squeaking on the tile, and an empty hallway with a mirrored ceiling stretches out in front of us. I feel a surge of triumph. I know this place. We aren't far now. We're going to make it. Stop! A voice shouts from behind me. The security guards. They found us. Stop or we'll shoot! Caleb shudders and lifts his hands. I lift mine too and look at him. I feel everything slow down inside me. My racing thoughts and the pounding of my heart. When I look at him, I don't see the cowardly young man who sold me out to Janine Matthews, and I don't hear the excuses he gave afterward. When I look at him, I see the boy who held my hand in the hospital when our mother broke her wrist and told me it would be all right. I see the brother who told me to make my own choices the night before the choosing ceremony. I think of all the remarkable things he is, smart and enthusiastic and observant, quiet and earnest and kind. He is a part of me, always will be, and I am a part of him too. I don't belong to Abnegation, or Dauntless, or even the Divergent. I don't belong to the Bureau, or the Experiment, or the Fringe. I belong to the people I love, and they belong to me. They, and the love and loyalty I give them, form my identity far more than any word or group ever could. I love my brother. I love him, and he is quaking with terror at the thought of death. I love him, and all I can think, all I can hear in my mind are the words I said to him a few days ago. I would never deliver you to your own execution. Caleb, I say, give me the backpack. What? He says. I slip my hand under the back of my shirt and grab my gun. I point it at him. Give me the backpack. Triss, no. He shakes his head. No, I won't let you do that. Put down your weapon, the guard screams at the end of the hallway. Put down your weapon or we will fire! I might survive the death serum, I say. I'm good at fighting off serums. There's a chance I'll survive. There's no chance you would survive. Give me the backpack or I'll shoot you in the leg and take it from you. Then I raise my voice so the guards can hear me. He's my hostage! Come any closer and I'll kill him! In that moment, he reminds me of our father. His eyes are tired and sad. There's a shadow of a beard on his chin. His hands shake as he pulls the backpack to the front of his body and offers it to me. I take it and swing it over my shoulder. I keep my gun pointed at him and shift so he's blocking my view of the soldiers at the end of the hallway. Caleb, I say, I love you. His eyes gleam with tears as he says, I love you too, Beatrice. Get down on the floor, I yell for the benefit of the guards. Caleb sinks to his knees. If I don't survive, I say, tell Tobias I didn't want to leave him. I back up, aiming over Caleb's shoulder at one of the security guards. I inhale and steady my hand. I exhale and fire. I hear a pained yell and sprint in the other direction with the sound of gunfire in my ears. I run a crooked path so it's harder to hit me, and then dive around the corner. A bullet hits the wall right behind me, putting a hole in it. As I run, I swing the backpack around my body and open the zipper. I take out the explosives and the detonator. There are shouts and running footsteps behind me. I don't have any time. I don't have any time. I run harder, faster than I thought I could. The impact of each footstep shudders through me, and I turn the next corner, where there are two guards standing by the doors Nita and the invaders broke. Clutching the explosives and detonator to my chest with my free hand, I shoot one guard in the leg and the other in the chest. The one I shot in the leg reaches for his gun, and I fire again, closing my eyes after I aim. He doesn't move again. I run past the broken doors and into the hallway between them. I slam the explosives against the metal bar where the two doors join and clamp down the claws around the edge of the bar so it will stay. Then I run back to the end of the hallway and around the corner and crouch, my back to the doors, as I press the detonation button and shield my ears with my palms. The noise vibrates in my bones as the small bomb detonates, and the force of the blast throws me sideways, my gun sliding across the floor. Pieces of glass and metal spray through the air, falling to the floor where I lie, stunned. Even though I sealed off my ears with my hands, I still hear ringing when I take them away, and I feel unsteady on my feet. At the end of the hallway, the guards have caught up with me. They fire, and a bullet hits me in the fleshy part of my arm. I scream, clapping my hand over the wound, and my vision goes spotty at the edges as I throw myself around the corner again, half walking and half stumbling to the blasted open doors. Beyond them is a small vestibule with a set of sealed, lockless doors at the other end. Through the windows in those doors, I see the weapons lab, the even rows of machinery and dark devices and serum vials, lit from beneath like they're on display. I hear a spraying sound and know that the death serum is floating through the air, but the guards are behind me, and I don't have time to put on the suit that will delay its effects. I also know, I just know, that I can survive this. I step into the vestibule.
Chapter 48. Tobias. Factionless headquarters, but this building will always be erudite headquarters to me, no matter what happens, stands silent in the snow, with nothing but glowing windows to signal that there are people inside. I stop in front of the doors and make a disgruntled sound in my throat. "What?" Peter says. "I hate it here," I say. He pushes his hair soaked from the snow out of his eyes. "So what are we going to do, break a window? Look for a back door?" "I'm just going to walk in," I say. "I'm her son."
"You also betrayed her and left the city when she forbade anyone from doing that," he says. "And she sent people after you to stop you. People with guns."
"You can stay here if you want," I say.
"Where the serum goes, I go," he says. "But if you get shot at, I'm going to grab it and run."
I don't expect anything more. He is a strange sort of person. I walk into the lobby where someone reassembled the portrait of Janine Matthews, but they drew an X over each of her eyes in red paint and wrote "Faction Scum" across the bottom. Several people wearing factionless armbands advance on us with guns held high. Some of them I recognize from across the factionless warehouse campfires, or from the time I spent at Evelyn's side as a dauntless leader. Others are complete strangers, reminding me that the factionless population is larger than any of us suspected. I put up my hands. "I'm here to see Evelyn."
"Sure," one of them says, "because we just let anyone in who wants to see her."
"I have a message from the people outside," I say, "one I'm sure she would like to hear."
"Tobias?"
a factionless woman says. I recognize her, but not from a factionless warehouse, from the abnegation sector. She was my neighbor. Grace is her name. "Hello, Grace," I say. "I just want to talk to my mom." She bites the inside of her cheek and considers me. Her grip on her pistol falters.
"Well, we're still not supposed to let anyone in."
"For God's sake," Peter says. "Go tell her we're here and see what she says then. We can wait."
Grace backs up into the crowd that gathered as we were talking, then lowers her gun and jogs down a nearby hallway. We stand for what feels like a long time until my shoulders ache from supporting my arms. Then Grace returns and beckons to us. I lower my hands as the others lower their guns and walk into the foyer, passing through the center of the crowd like a piece of thread through the eye of a needle. She leads us into an elevator.
"What are you doing holding a gun, Grace?" I say. I've never known an abnegation to pick up a weapon.
"No faction customs anymore," she says. "Now I get to defend myself. I get to have a sense of self-preservation."
"Good," I say, and I mean it. Abnegation was just as broken as the other factions, but its evils were less obvious, cloaked as they were in the guise of selflessness. But requiring a person to disappear, to fade into the background wherever they go, is no better than encouraging them to punch one another. We go up to the floor where Janine's administrative office was, but that's not where Grace takes us. Instead, she leads us to a large meeting room with tables, couches, and chairs arranged in strict squares. Huge windows along the back wall let in the moonlight. Evelyn sits at a table on the right, staring out the window.
"You can go, Grace," Evelyn says.
You have a message for me, Tobias?
She doesn't look at me. Her thick hair is tied back in a knot, and she wears a gray shirt with a factionless armband over it. She looks exhausted. Mind waiting in the hallway? I say to Peter, and to my surprise he doesn't argue. He just walks out, closing the door behind him. My mother and I are alone. The people outside have no messages for us, I say, moving closer to her. They wanted to take away the memories of everyone in this city. They believe there is no reasoning with us, no appealing to our better natures. They decided it would be easier to erase us than to speak with us.
Maybe they're right, Evelyn says.
Finally she turns to me, resting her cheekbone against her clasped hands. She has an empty circle tattooed on one of her fingers like a wedding band.
What is it you came here to do, then?
I hesitate, my hand on the vial in my pocket. I look at her, and I can see the way time has worn through her like an old piece of cloth, the fibers exposed and fraying. And I can see the woman I knew as a child, too. The mouth that stretched into a smile, the eyes that sparkled with joy. But the longer I look at her, the more convinced I am that that happy woman never existed. That woman is just a pale version of my real mother, viewed through the self-centered eyes of a child. I sit down across from her at the table and put the vial of memory serum between us. I came to make you drink this, I say. She looks at the vial, and I think I see tears in her eyes, but it could just be the light. I thought it was the only way to prevent total destruction, I say. I know that Marcus and Johanna and their people are going to attack, and I know that you will do whatever it takes to stop them, including using that death serum you possess to its best advantage. I tilt my head. Am I wrong?
No, she says. The factions are evil. They cannot be restored. I would sooner see us all destroyed.
Her hand squeezes the edge of the table, the knuckles pale.
The reason the factions were evil is because there was no way out of them, I say. They gave us the illusion of choice without actually giving us a choice. That's the same thing you're doing here by abolishing them. You're saying, go make choices, but make sure they aren't factions or I'll grind you to bits.
If you thought that, why didn't you tell me? She says, her voice louder and her eyes avoiding mine, avoiding me.
Tell me instead of betraying me.
Because I'm afraid of you. The words burst out and I regret them, but I'm also glad they're there. Glad that before I ask her to give up her identity, I can at least be honest with her.
You remind me of him. Don't you dare.
She clenches her hands into fists and almost spits at me.
Don't you dare. I don't care if you don't want to hear it, I say, coming to my feet. He was a tyrant in our house, and now you're a tyrant in this city. And you can't even see that it's the same. So that's why you brought this, she says, and wraps her hand around the vial, holding it up to look at it. Because you think this is the only way to mend things.
I am about to say that it's the easiest way, the best way, maybe the only way that I can trust her. If I erase her memories, I can create for myself a new mother. But she is more than my mother. She is a person in her own right, and she does not belong to me. I do not get to choose what she becomes just because I can't deal with who she is. No, I say. No. I came to give you a choice. I feel suddenly terrified, my hands numb, my heart beating fast. I thought about going to see Marcus tonight, but I didn't. I swallow hard. I came to see you instead because I think there's a hope of reconciliation between us. Not now, not soon, but someday. And with him there's no hope. There's no reconciliation possible. She stares at me, her eyes fierce but welling up with tears. It's not fair for me to give you this choice, I say, but I have to. You can lead the factionless. You can fight the Allegiant, but you'll have to do it without me. forever. Or you can let this crusade go, and you'll have your son back. It's a feeble offer, and I know it. Which is why I'm afraid. Afraid that she will refuse to choose. That she will choose power over me. That she will call me a ridiculous child, which is what I am. I am a child. I am 2 feet tall, and asking her how much she loves me. Evelyn's eyes, dark as wet earth, search mine for a long time. Then she reaches across the table and pulls me fiercely into her arms, which form a wire cage around me, surprisingly strong. "Let them have the city and everything in it," she says into my hair. I can't move. Can't speak. She chose me. She chose me.
Chapter 49. Triss. The death serum smells like smoke and spice, and my lungs reject it with the first breath I take. I cough and splutter, and I'm swallowed by darkness. I crumple to my knees. My body feels like someone has replaced my blood with molasses and my bones with lead. An invisible thread tugs me toward sleep, but I want to be awake. It is important that I want to be awake. I imagine that wanting, that desire burning in my chest like a flame. The thread tugs harder, and I stoke the flame with names. Tobias, Caleb, Christina, Matthew, Kara, Zeke, Uriah. But I can't bear up under the serum's weight. My body falls to the side, and my wounded arm presses to the cold ground. I am drifting. It would be nice to float away, a voice in my head says. To see where I will go. But the fire, the desire to live, I am not done yet. I am not. I feel like I am digging through my own mind. It is difficult to remember why I came here, and why I care about unburdening myself from this beautiful weight. But then, my scratching hands find it. The memory of my mother's face, and the strange angles of her limbs on the pavement, and the blood seeping from my father's body. But they are dead, the voice says. You could join them. They died for me, I answer. And now I have something to do in return. I have to stop other people from losing everything. I have to save the city and the people my mother and father loved. If I go to join my parents, I want to carry with me a good reason. Not this senseless collapsing at the threshold. The fire. It rages within. A campfire and then an inferno, and my body is its fuel. I feel it racing through me, eating away at the weight. There is nothing that can kill me now. I am powerful and invincible and eternal. I feel the serum clinging to my skin like oil, but the darkness recedes. I slap a heavy hand over the floor and push myself up. Bent at the waist, I shove my shoulder into the double doors, and they squeak across the floor as their seal breaks. I breathe clean air and stand up straighter. I am there. I am there. But I am not alone. Don't move, David says, raising his gun. Hello, Triss. Chapter 50. Triss. How did you inoculate yourself against the death serum? He asks me.
He's still sitting in his wheelchair, but you don't need to be able to walk to fire a gun. I blink at him, still dazed. I didn't, I say.
Don't be stupid, David says. You can't survive the death serum without an inoculation, and I'm the only person in the compound who possesses that substance.
I just stare at him, not sure what to say. I didn't inoculate myself. The fact that I'm still standing upright is impossible. There's nothing more to add.
I suppose it no longer matters, he says.
We're here now.
What are you doing here? I mumble. My lips feel awkwardly large, hard to talk around. I still feel that oily heaviness on my skin, like death is clinging to me, even though I have defeated it.
I am dimly aware that I left my own gun in the hallway behind me. Sure, I wouldn't need it if I made it this far.
I knew something was going on, David says. You've been running around with genetically damaged people all week, Triss. Did you think I wouldn't notice?
He shakes his head.
And then your friend Kara was caught trying to manipulate the lights. But she very wisely knocked herself out before she could tell us anything. So I came here, just in case. I'm sad to say I'm not surprised to see you.
You came here alone? I say. Not very smart, are you? His bright eyes squint a little.
Well, you see, I have death serum resistance and a weapon, and you have no way to fight me. There's no way you can steal 4 virus devices while I have you at gunpoint. I'm afraid you've come all this way for no reason, and it will be at the expense of your life. The death serum may not have killed you, but I am going to. I'm sure you understand. Officially, we don't allow capital punishment, but I can't have you surviving this.
He thinks I'm here to steal the weapons that will reset the experiments, not deploy one of them. Of course he does. I try to guard my expression, though I'm sure it's still slack. I sweep my eyes across the room, searching for the device that will release the memory serum virus. I was there when Matthew described it to Caleb in painstaking detail earlier. A black box with a silver keypad, marked with a strip of blue tape with a model number written on it. It is one of the only items on the counter along the left wall, just a few feet away from me. But I can't move, or else he'll kill me. I'll have to wait for the right moment, and do it fast.
I know what you did, I say. I start to back up, hoping that the accusation will distract him. I know you designed the attack simulation. I know you're responsible for my parents' deaths, for my mother's death. I know. I am not responsible for her death, David says, the words bursting from him, too loud and too sudden. I told her what was coming just before the attack began, so she had enough time to escort her loved ones to a safe house. If she had stayed put, she would have lived. But she was a foolish woman who didn't understand making sacrifices for the greater good, and it killed her.
I frown at him. There's something about his reaction, about the glassiness of his eyes, something that he mumbled when Nita shot him with the fear serum. Something about her.
Did you love her? I say. All those years, she was sending you correspondence. The reason you never wanted her to stay there. The reason you told her you couldn't read her updates anymore after she married my father.
David sits still, like a statue, like a man of stone.
I did, he says. But that time is past.
That must be why he welcomed me into his circle of trust, why he gave me so many opportunities. Because I am a piece of her, wearing her hair and speaking with her voice. Because he has spent his life grasping at her and coming up with nothing. I hear footsteps in the hallway outside. The soldiers are coming. Good. I need them to. I need them to be exposed to the airborne serum, to pass it on to the rest of the compound. I hope they wait until the air is clear of death serum.
My mother wasn't a fool, I say. She just understood something you didn't. That it's not sacrifice if it's someone else's life you're giving away. It's just evil.
I back up another step and say, she taught me all about real sacrifice. That it should be done from love, not misplaced disgust for another person's genetics. That it should be done from necessity, not without exhausting all other options. That it should be done for people who need your strength because they don't have enough of their own. That's why I need to stop you from sacrificing all those people and their memories. Why I need to rid the world of you, once and for all. I shake my head. I didn't come here to steal anything, David. I twist and lunge toward the device. The gun goes off, and pain races through my body. I don't even know where the bullet hit me. I can still hear Caleb repeating the code for Matthew. With a quaking hand, I type in the numbers on the keypad. The gun goes off again. More pain, and black edges on my vision. But I hear Caleb's voice speaking again. The green button. So much pain. But how? When my body feels so numb. I start to fall and slam my hand into the keypad on my way down. A light turns on behind the green button. I hear a beep and a churning sound. I slide to the floor. I feel something warm on my neck and under my cheek. Red. Blood is a strange color. Dark. From the corner of my eye, I see David, slumped over in his chair. And my mother, walking out from behind him. She is dressed in the same clothes she wore the last time I saw her. Abnegation gray, stained with her blood, with bare arms to show her tattoo. There are still bullet holes in her shirt. Through them, I can see her wounded skin, red but no longer bleeding, like she's frozen in time. Her dull blonde hair is tied back in a knot, but a few loose strands frame her face in gold. I know she can't be alive, but I don't know if I'm seeing her now because I'm delirious from the blood loss, or if the death serum has addled my thoughts, or if she is here in some other way. She kneels next to me and touches a cool hand to my cheek. "Hello, Beatrice," she says, and she smiles. "Am I done yet?" I say, and I'm not sure if I actually say it or if I just think it and she hears it. "Yes," she says, her eyes bright with tears. "My dear child, you've done so well." "What about the others?" I choke on a sob as the image of Tobias comes into my mind, of how dark and how still his eyes were, how strong and warm his hand was when we first stood face to face. "Tobias, Caleb, my friends." "They'll care for each other," she says. "That's what people do." I smile and close my eyes. I feel a thread tugging me again, but this time, I know it isn't some sinister force dragging me toward death. This time, I know it's my mother's hand, drawing me into her arms, and I go gladly into her embrace. Can I be forgiven for all I've done to get here? I want to be. I can. I believe it.
Chapter 51. Tobias. Evelyn brushes the tears from her eyes with her thumb. We stand by the window, shoulder to shoulder, watching the snow swirl past. Some of the flakes gather on the windowsill outside, piling at the corners. The feeling has returned to my hands. As I stare out at the world, dusted in white, I feel like everything has begun again, and it will be better this time. "I think I can get in touch with Marcus over the radio to negotiate a peace agreement," Evelyn says. "He'll be listening in. He'd be stupid not to." "Before you do that, I made a promise I have to keep," I say. I touch Evelyn's shoulder. I expect to see strain at the edges of her smile, but I don't. I feel a twinge of guilt. I didn't come here to ask her to lay down arms for me, to trade in everything she's worked for just to get me back. But then again, I didn't come here to give her any choice at all. I guess Triss was right. When you have to choose between two bad options, you pick the one that saves the people you love. I wouldn't have been saving Evelyn by giving her that serum. I would have been destroying her. Peter sits with his back to the wall in the hallway. He looks up at me when I lean over him, his dark hair stuck to his forehead from the melted snow. "Did you reset her?" he says. "No," I say. "Didn't think you would have the nerve." "It's not about nerve. You know what? Whatever." I shake my head and hold up the vial of memory serum. "Are you still set on this?" He nods. "You could just do the work, you know," I say. "You could make better decisions, make a better life." "Yeah, I could," he says. "But I won't. We both know that." "I do know that. I know that change is difficult and comes slowly, and that it is the work of many days strung together in a long line until the origin of them is forgotten. He is afraid that he will not be able to put in that work, that he will squander those days, and that they will leave him worse off than he is now. And I understand that feeling. I understand being afraid of yourself. So I have him sit on one of the couches, and I ask him what he wants me to tell him about himself after his memories disappear like smoke. He just shakes his head. Nothing. He wants to retain nothing. Peter takes the vial with shaking hands and twists off the cap. The liquid trembles inside it, almost spilling over the lip. He holds it under his nose to smell it. How much should I drink? He says. And I think I hear his teeth chattering. I don't think it makes a difference, I say. Okay. Well? Here goes. He lifts the vial up to the light like he is toasting me. When he touches it to his mouth, I say, be brave. Then he swallows. And I watch Peter disappear. The air outside tastes like ice. Hey! Peter! I shout. My breaths turn to vapor. Peter stands by the doorway to the erudite headquarters, looking clueless. At the sound of his name, which I have told him at least 10 times since he drank the serum, he raises his eyebrows, pointing to his chest. Matthew told us people would be disoriented for a while after drinking the memory serum, but I didn't think disoriented meant stupid until now. I sigh. Yes, that's you for the 11th time. Come on, let's go. I thought that when I looked at him after he drank the serum, I would still see the initiate who shoved a butter knife into Edward's eye, and the boy who tried to kill my girlfriend and all the other things he has done, stretching backward for as long as I've known him. But it's easier than I thought to see that he has no idea who he is anymore. His eyes still have that wide, innocent look, but this time, I believe it. Evelyn and I walk side by side, with Peter trotting behind us. The snow has stopped falling now, but enough is collected on the ground that it squeaks under my shoes. We walk to Millennium Park, where the mammoth bean sculpture reflects the moonlight, and then down a set of stairs. As we descend, Evelyn wraps her hand around my elbow to keep her balance, and we exchange a look. I wonder if she's as nervous as I am to face my father again. I wonder if she's nervous every time. At the bottom of the steps is a pavilion with 2 glass blocks, each one at least 3 times as tall as I am at either end. This is where we told Marcus and Johanna we would meet them, both parties armed, to be realistic, but even. They are already there. Johanna isn't holding a gun, but Marcus is, and he has it trained on Evelyn. I point the gun Evelyn gave me at him, just to be safe. I notice the planes of his skull showing through his shaved hair, and the jagged path his crooked nose carves down his face. Tobias, Johanna says. She wears a coat in amity red, dusted with snowflakes. What are you doing here? Trying to keep you all from killing each other, I say. I'm surprised you're carrying a gun. I nod to the bulge in her coat pocket, the unmistakable contours of a weapon. Sometimes you just have to take difficult measures to ensure peace, Johanna says. I believe you agree with that as a principle. We're not here to chat, Marcus says, looking at Evelyn. You said you wanted to talk about a treaty. The past few weeks have taken something from him. I can see it in the turned down corners of his mouth, in the purple skin under his eyes. I see my own eyes set into his skull, and I think of my reflection in the fear landscape, how terrified I was, watching his skin spread over mine like a rash. I am still nervous that I will become him, even now, standing at odds with him with my mother at my side like I always dreamed I would when I was a child. But I don't think that I am still afraid. Yes, Evelyn says. I have some terms for both of us to agree to. I think you will find them fair. If you agree to them, I will step down and surrender whatever weapons I have that my people are not using for personal protection. I will leave the city
and not return. Marcus laughs. I'm not sure if it's a mocking laugh or a disbelieving one. He's equally capable of either sentiment, an arrogant and deeply suspicious man. Let her finish, Johanna says quietly, tucking her hands into her sleeves. In return, Evelyn says, you will not attack or try to seize control of the city. You will allow those people who wish to leave and seek a new life elsewhere to do so. You will allow those who choose to stay to vote on new leaders and a new social system. And most importantly, you, Marcus, will not be eligible to lead them. It is the only purely selfish term of the peace agreement. She told me she couldn't stand the thought of Marcus duping more people into following him, and I didn't argue with her. Johanna raises her eyebrows. I notice that she has pulled her hair back on both sides to reveal the scar in its entirety. She looks better that way, stronger when she is not hiding behind a curtain of hair, hiding who she is. No deal, Marcus says. I am the leader of these people. Marcus, Johanna says. He ignores her. You don't get to decide whether I lead them or not because you have a grudge against me, Evelyn. Excuse me, Johanna says loudly. Marcus, what she is offering is too good to be true. We get everything we want without all the violence. How can you possibly say no? Because I am the rightful leader of these people, Marcus says. I am the leader of the Allegiant. No, you are not, Johanna says calmly. I am the leader of the Allegiant. And you are going to agree to this treaty, or I am going to tell them that you had a chance to end this conflict without bloodshed if you sacrificed your pride. And you said no. Marcus's passive mask is gone, revealing the malicious face beneath it. But even he can't argue with Johanna, whose perfect calm and perfect threat have mastered him. He shakes his head, but doesn't argue again. I agree to your terms, Johanna says, and she holds out her hand, her footsteps squeaking in the snow. Evelyn removes her glove, fingertip by fingertip, reaches across the gap, and shakes. In the morning we should gather everyone together and tell them the new plan, Johanna says. Can you guarantee a safe gathering? I'll do my best, Evelyn says. I check my watch. An hour has passed since Amar and Christina separated from us near the Hancock building, which means he probably knows that the serum virus didn't work. Or maybe he doesn't. Either way, I have to do what I came here to do. I have to find Zeke and his mother and tell them what happened to Uriah. I should go, I say to Evelyn. I have something else to take care of. But I'll pick you up from the city limits tomorrow afternoon.
That sounds good, Evelyn says.
And she rubs my arm briskly with a gloved hand like she used to when I came in from the cold as a child. You won't be back, I assume, Johanna says to me. You found a life for yourself on the outside? I have, I say. Good luck in here. The people outside, they're going to try to shut the city down. You should be ready for them. Johanna smiles.
I'm sure we can negotiate with them.
She offers me her hand and I shake it. I feel Marcus's eyes on me like an oppressive weight threatening to crush me. I force myself to look at him. Goodbye, I say to him. And I mean it. Hannah, Zeke's mother, has small feet that don't touch the ground when she sits in the easy chair in their living room. She is wearing a ragged black bathrobe and slippers, but the air she has with her hands folded in her lap and her eyebrows raised is so dignified that I feel like I am standing in front of a world leader. I glance at Zeke, who is rubbing his face with his fists to wake up. Amar and Christina found them, not among the other revolutionaries near the Hancock building, but in their family apartment in the pyre above Dauntless headquarters. I only found them because Christina thought to leave Peter and me a note with their location on the useless truck. Peter is waiting in the new van Evelyn found for us to drive to the bureau.
I'm sorry, I say. I don't know where to start.
You might begin with the worst,
Hannah says. Like what exactly happened to my son?
He was seriously injured during an attack, I say. There was an explosion, and he was very close to it.
Oh, God,
Zeke says, and he rocks back and forth like his body wants to be a child again, soothed by motion as a child is. But Hannah just bends her head, hiding her face from me. Their living room smells like garlic and onion, maybe remnants from that night's dinner. I lean my shoulder into the white wall by the doorway. Hanging crookedly next to me is a picture of the family. Zeke as a toddler, Uriah as a baby balancing on his mother's lap. Their father's face is pierced in several places, nose and ear and lip, but his wide, bright smile and dark complexion are more familiar to me, because he passed them both to his sons.
He has been in a coma since then, I say.
And he isn't going to wake up,
Hannah says, her voice strained.
That is what you came to tell us, right?
Yes, I say. I came to collect you so that you can make a decision on his behalf.
A decision?
Zeke says.
You mean to unplug him or not?
Zeke,
Hannah says, and she shakes her head. He sinks back into the couch. The cushions seem to wrap around him.
Of course we don't want to keep him alive that way,
Hannah says.
He would want to move on. But we would like to go see him.
I nod. Of course.
But there's something else I should say.
The attack. It was a kind of uprising that involved some of the people from the place we were staying. And I participated in it. I stare at the crack in the floorboards right in front of me. At the dust that has gathered there over time and wait for a reaction. Any reaction. What greets me is only silence. I didn't do what you asked me, I said to Zeke. I didn't watch out for him the way I should have, and I'm sorry. I chance a look at him, and he is just sitting still, staring at the empty vase on the coffee table. It is painted with faded pink roses.
I think we need some time with this,
Hannah says. She clears her throat, but it doesn't help her tremulous voice. I wish I could give it to you, I say, but we're going back to the compound very soon, and you have to come with us.
All right,
Hannah says.
If you can wait outside, we will be there in 5 minutes.
The ride back to the compound is slow and dark. I watch the moon disappear and reappear behind the clouds as we bump over the ground. When we reach the outer limits of the city, it begins to snow again, large light flakes that swirl in front of the headlights. I wonder if Triss is watching it sweep across the pavement and gather in piles by the airplanes. I wonder if she is living in a better world than the one I left, among people who no longer remember what it is to have pure genes. Christina leans forward to whisper in my ear.
So you did it? It worked?
I nod. In the rearview mirror, I see her touch her face with both hands, grinning into her palms. I know how she feels. Safe. We are all safe. Did you inoculate your family? I say.
Yep. We found them with the Allegiant in the Hancock building, she says. But the time for the reset has passed. It looks like Triss and Caleb stopped it.
Hannah and Zeke murmur to each other on the way, marveling at the strange, dark world we move through. Amar gives the basic explanation as we go, looking back at them instead of the road far too often for my comfort. I try to ignore my surges of panic as he almost veers into streetlights or road barriers and focus instead on the snow. I have always hated the emptiness that winter brings, the blank landscape and the stark difference between sky and ground, the way it transforms trees into skeletons and the city into a wasteland. Maybe this winter I can be persuaded otherwise. We drive past the fences and stop by the front doors, which are no longer manned by guards. We get out, and Zeke seizes his mother's hand to steady her as she shuffles through the snow. As we walk into the compound, I know for a fact that Caleb succeeded, because there is no one in sight.
That can only mean that they have been reset, their memories forever altered.
Where is everyone? Omar says.
We walk through the abandoned security.